Welcome to this episode of The World According to Irina Shukerman, our very special series on global politics on the KJ Masterclass Live. Irina Shukerman is a US-based national security and human rights lawyer as well as a renowned geopolitical analyst. Her writings and commentary have appeared in diverse US and international media and have been translated to over a dozen languages. Every fortnight in The World According to Irina Shukerman, we traverse the geopolitical landscape and delve into pressing international issues and gain insight from Irina's expert perspective. Welcome to the show once again, Irina.
Thank you. Glad to be here as always.
You are welcome. Welcome to the show. Welcome. Several big topics today again, Irina, from Indian and Chinese ammunition in Ukraine to diplomatic crisis. In between Ecuador and Mexico, a lot of things happening. So let's first go to this diplomatic crisis between Ecuador and Mexico. What has happened? Is it good? Is it bad? You know, Ecuador police getting into Mexican embassy and all, and they are also looking at getting into, you know, internal politics of Ecuador. So help us understand, what is this whole crisis for a simple person to understand?
So essentially, a senior Ecuador politician, a former wife, he ended up seeking asylum from criminal prosecution at the Mexican embassy. And usually when that happens, they have diplomatic cover, because an embassy is supposed to be a country's sovereign territory. But Ecuador was so intense, they asked Mexico to release that guy into their custody. Mexico refused, so the Ecuador forces stormed the embassy and essentially grabbed him, which led to a political crisis. And Mexico denounced this step. They broke diplomatic relations and they evacuated all of their staff back home. So now there's another political crisis in Latin America. And, you know, it's kind of mind-boggling because this is such a minor incident. It involves one Ecuadorian politician who, you know, for all intents and purposes, fled to another country. And this was the equivalent of invading Mexico just to recover this one guy. And I'm not sure that it was worth it, considering that you know, was he worth severing diplomatic relations and ending, you know, and having probably trade and political repercussions? I'm not sure about that.
Right, Irina. But from a people talk about diplomatic immunity. So embassies do have, you know, ambassadors do have that, their staff do have, so to a certain extent, this diplomatic immunity. But does that also mean that, you know, that local governments may think you are sheltering some people if they are having some cases against them, you are interfering in the local affairs of the country? How do you see this? This incident seems to be happening more and more with, you know, politicians seeking asylum in, you know, in different embassies. And people locally, every government will look at it differently. Some people may think it is interference in their, you know, misusing diplomatic immunity and actually interfering in their in their political affairs. How do you see it?
Well, generally, there's only a few countries that all these politicians look to, and it's usually that countries that don't have extradition treaties with the countries that they're fleeing. So in that case, it's not so, it's usually the same server. And by the way, Ecuador is a little hypocritical here, because they themselves gave similar asylum to Julian Assange, who is now in UK and could spend there a great deal of time. So given that they themselves are involved in harboring people who were wanted for various crimes, I really don't think that they're in a position to claim that other countries are interfering in their peer. I mean, it's no more interference than somebody fleeing to a different country and seeking asylum there. I mean, depending on the level of crime, if it's a, you know, if it's a regular crime, then usually their extradition treaties work. But if it's a purely political issue, and it's literally just a matter of difference in politics, I think, you know, these countries are entitled to look at it differently. Now, it's not clear what happened with this official, whether he was indeed guilty of these crimes or not. But you can't, I don't think Mexico was in a position to make that decision very quickly. And perhaps this is someone they were familiar with from his prior work in his official capacity. So the situation put them in a difficult position, because here they are with somebody who they've had a prior relationship with. This is not just some Ecuadorian citizen that they know nothing about. This is someone they've worked with. And now there's a different government, and you know, there's a political dispute, and they don't know whether this guy is guilty. But imagine if somebody who you know comes to you and asks for help, to at least, and at least you need time to figure out whether that person deserves help or not. So I don't think it's unreasonable to let him stay at least for a little while until they figure it out. So I think Ecuador definitely overstepped their boundaries in taking these things by force. I think they were entitled to badger Mexican government, to call them repeatedly and to provide evidence, but storming is not an storming an embassy and violating sovereignty is not an answer to a dispute.
Absolutely, absolutely. So where do the relations go from here? How is the world looking at this? You know, the Mexican ambassador, he's back in you know, Mexico. And so how does it all look like from a world's perspective? Where is Ecuador standing alone, or are there people who are supporting them?
Well, I think many people were horrified, because this is not a normal incident. Usually it's a, you know, something like that could be considered an act of war, definitely highly disrespectful. So I don't think people are going to be openly backing Ecuador about the course of action, whether or not they agree that that guy was should have gotten any sort of asylum. They don't think that the response was appropriate at all. I think, you know, Ecuador and Mexico will, you know, I think they will, this dispute is not a top priority for anybody right now, because as we are speaking, Venezuela is further advancing its interest in the nearby Guyana, and that is a conflict with that is much more likely to end in to lead to some sort of violence. Mexico and Ecuador for now is simply a political dispute. We don't foresee a war with them over that incident. It is, however, going to be a harsh and probably unpleasant dispute for a while. Don't see that ending quickly unless Ecuador makes complete demands and apologies and follows the and commits to following the protocol. But I just don't think it's going to happen in the next few days. It might take some time.
Right. Arira, thank you for that, helping us understand that situation between Ecuador and Mexico. Now let's come back to the war in Ukraine, but India and China here getting involved. Indian ammunition, Chinese ammunition in Ukraine. What does this mean? Indian government has, you know, denied any of this, but some of these pictures showing how did this ammunition land up in, and what is it? Suddenly all these things happening, India coming into the picture first, the Indian soldiers getting, you know, being part of the Chinese, Russian side, Ukraine side, and now, you know, even the assassination attempt news, and now this Indian ammunition news. How do you make sense of this? Firstly, help us understand, how did Indian ammunition get there, or is there something much bigger that is cooking on that in the war between Russia and Ukraine, plus US and Europe?
So the funny thing is about this whole situation is the specific type of ammunition we are talking about, the 125 millimeter shells, are basically co-produced with the Russian producer. This is not a completely unique Indian weapon, you know, ammunition that's ended up there. So I really don't think that something like that could have been done overtly. I doubt that Russia would have given its permission, nor would India want to violate its relations with Russia over this. This is not the type of thing they would have given openly, you know, because this is something that's co-produced with another country. But according to the article, Slovakia, which has bought this type of weapon in the past, was the one who provided Ukraine with that for their own reasons, not because they conspired with India about that. Slovakia, however, denied that. They claimed that this did not happen and that the Ukrainian soldiers procured it somewhere else, possibly on black market, being resold by people who just needed money from somewhere and happened to have, you know, shells that they bought earlier for their own reasons and never got to use because they had no need for them. So it may have been entirely incidental, but what is much less likely incidental is the Chinese weapons and ammunition ending up in Russia's hands, because China, although they denied providing that specific type of ammunition, is known to be arming Russia with the light arms as well as non-lethal weapons and other things. Moreover, China has also been selling various types of weapons and ammunition all over the Middle East, and from there those weapons could end up literally anyway, and most likely with the Russians, who are quite present in Syria, where a lot of these weapons are spreading and have easy access to buying them from there. So I think China has a fairly good idea of how these weapons end up, where they end up. I don't think they mind. I think they would have... I think the only thing they really denied is that they deliberately sold that particular thing directly to Russians. But I think they're quite aware that Russians have an easy way of getting them. Now, what does that all mean at the end of the day? It all means that despite the fact that India may not have had any intent on arming Ukraine directly, what happens is they are facing off the fact that China's influence in this conflict is growing. And like it or not, China, which is hostile to India, as we have repeatedly seen, including in the latest developments, is very closely politically and militarily aligning with Russia. And moreover, it's competing. There's a sense of competition on the defense fronts between China and India. So despite the fact that this incident may not have been planned by all the actors, it does bring up the point that China and India, at the end of the day, are defense rivals, and that India may want to figure out a way of how they can end up not being completely sidelined from this conflict by China, which does not seem to mind being seen as outright taking sides against Western countries. India does try to have good relations with everybody. It does military exercises with different countries. It's part of BRICS, which is an economic alliance. But at the end of the day, in terms of military, it is part of the Quad, which is, you know, openly concerned about China's influence. And so this influence may soon be taking place, this competition outside Indo-Pacific and in other regions of the world. For now, this may be incidental, it may be more optics than substance, but that could change in the near future.
Right, right. As I said, India is coming a lot more into news, and news are emanating from that part of the world. Here, German newspaper, and now even the assassination attempts in Pakistan, so-called assassination attempts, in Pakistan of some of the terrorists. The report Pakistan had come out with this in January. Again, some newspaper is coming out that, okay, we have talked to some intelligence officers, both on the Indian side, on the Pakistani side, without naming anyone, without anything. So what does it mean? What does it all this, you know, news mean for India? How should India understand it? And also, in the India is busy saving a lot of ships, rescuing ships, Iranian ship very recently, from, you know, from Somalian pirates. So how should Indians understand all these news emanating? And at the same time, India is doing a lot of good in that part of the world.
So this is interesting, because the accounts accusing India of this are all anonymous. This alleged intelligence officers, nobody knows who they are or if they even exist. Anyone can say, the intelligence officer told me this, and you'll never know. But
even Indian intelligence officers.
Yeah, I mean, It's really amazing that, you know, you can just basically make that claim without having to substantiate who those people were and at least what rank they were in, why they were sharing that information with the Guardian of all places, not particularly an India-friendly publication. But this is not the first time these allegations were made about these Khalistani terrorists. And the funny thing is, we were just talking about, you know, asylum. Now, the difference in this, first of all, there's absolutely no clear evidence that this actually happened, nor has the international community made those claims. This is claims made entirely by the Guardian. I don't see anyone else. You know, there was real outrage over the incidents in Canada and the United States, but when it comes to this particular story, it seems to be riding on the coattails of the previous accusations. But, you know, it's funny because there is a difference between, on the one hand, giving asylum to some political opposition, and on the other hand, completely politically enabling these people to continue their activity that got them in the hot water to begin with. That is, you know, the first thing is just what countries choose to do with their own immigration system. The other is actually political interference in the country's affairs. And if Pakistan is indeed helping these Khalistanis, engage in acts of violence and separatism and violate Indian laws, then they themselves are participating in violating India's sovereignty by assisting in that manner. And we have seen in the past that Pakistan has backed various extremist organizations in Kashmir and other places, and I would not be shocked if these Khalistanis who are there are serving a purpose beyond just propaganda of Pakistan's, you know, helping asylum seekers. I think there could be something, they could be useful to security services, and I think there's a lot more to the story there. But I also don't think, if it's so easy to assassinate 20 people in Pakistan, then how well are the security services doing their job? I mean, I would not be boasting about that in public if I were Pakistan. I mean, I would probably try to resolve that issue quietly so that no one found out, instead of going public about how badly they're working, that 20 asylum seekers got assassinated. So I think the Guardian is trying to spin the story, you know, as a form of propaganda, but I don't think it has the effect they think it does, simply because it's not putting Pakistan in a particular great light here.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Arina. So looks like, do you think more such, you know, news or reports will continue to come as, you know, as US gets closer to elections and there is this whole talk of NATO seeking defense independence from US, what if possible $100 billion for Ukraine aid, and Sweden also coming into the picture. So tell us about this vis-a-vis wars on that part of the world, and what does the world want from India? How can India help them? Is it just the market, or they want more involvement from India politically? We have been non-aligned from a very, very long time.
So the funny thing is, India is in fact actually increasingly playing a more global role. As you rightly pointed out, they have been involved in very successful rescue missions in the Pacific, including not only their own, but international ships, including most recently Iranian vessel that was attacked by pirates who are obviously opportunistically taking advantage of the chaos created by Houthi attacks to pursue their own criminal agenda. And that's catching attention for India in a very good way, without necessarily creating additional conflicts, just putting them on the map as, you know, as having both the goodwill and also the capabilities of performing a vital task, while also being independent in that regard. India has not joined up with either the US Defense Coalition or with the European Union. It's playing its own independent role, but it is still a vital function, and it's still being contributing to freedom of navigation in the area, and it's also showcasing India's growing willingness to engage internationally and beyond its, own self-defense industries. And I think it's actually moving much faster than anyone could have predicted. And, I think it's just fine. With regards to whether the international community wants India to become more assertive, more and less neutral, and not just merely contain itself to defensive operations, neutral, of providing assistance to ships in need, but also to become kind of to engage in more offensive operations. I think that might come in the future. It may not come today or tomorrow, but it may become necessary out of India's own self-preservation and interest, because I think that China, for its own part, is becoming much more aggressive, much faster than anyone could have predicted, probably because of all the simultaneous chaos and weak U.S. foreign policy and general kind of disunity among various Western allies. So I think India may be forced to take a much more assertive maritime and other positions in the near future. I don't think it's going to happen quite as quickly with the Ukraine conflict. That said, I think in the end of the day, it's also in India's interest to contribute to global stability and security. And I do think that from a humanitarian perspective, it may, in the near future, as it develops economically, may be in a position to contribute to reconstruction, to humanitarian assistance, to various humanitarian operations, and even mediations and conflict resolution on par with some of the other actors who've attempted to play that role, and with much more credibility. So I do think India may have a bigger role to play. I think it will be gradual. I think it will be on its own terms. And I think we may yet be surprised. I don't think it does anyone any good to try to rush it. I just don't think it's going to happen, first of all. and second, when you try to rush things, then they spin out of control and you end up, things don't go well. It's better to move gradually and to see things develop. And I think the West can engage with India on specific narrow issues. And I think they are not thinking creatively by trying to just try to tackle with everything at once. Either you contribute to the fund or you start voting with us with the UN. There are smaller issues that there could be engagement about, with maybe providing medical, non-lethal humanitarian assistance and all sorts of things that cannot be interpreted as anything political. I think this is where we should be starting to engage in a very small, practical measures that are not likely to cause any more conflicts, divisions, or put anyone in an awkward position. I think people need to start thinking a bit more pragmatically. With respect to the big $100 billion fund, it is not a bad idea. The problem is NATO is not one entity. NATO is a collection of countries with very different financial means and different interests, and they are all struggling internally within their own domestic sphere. We have seen the outcome of that in Slovakia, where a pro-Russian party came to power. We're seeing even in Czechia, which has been extremely helpful to Ukraine, a lot of these issues. And until these countries are able to manage and tackle their own domestic affairs and gain control of the narrative to the point that they have that these political processes cannot be disrupted by alternative theories, it will be very difficult for them to come together for anything substantial and controversial. And this is the problem that they're currently seeking. For Russia, it's easy. Russia is one country. It does not need to coordinate with a whole bunch of different members. It just does what it feels like doing. And whoever is with it, like China, whatever, it will cooperate on on whatever terms it manages to obtain, but it doesn't need to come together and figure out this whole strategy. So on the one hand, that makes it kind of foolhardy and risky, because you don't have counsel of other countries, but on the other hand, it can move much faster. So NATO is very slow moving, because, and the more members it obtains, the more difficult it's actually to make decisions on any one issue.
Right, right. And talking of Russia, Japanese senior executive founded in Russia. What should we read into it? Was it any kind of foul play? Because he was very close to, you know, to the establishment. And at the same time, Russia is holding talks with Taliban. What is this happening? Means Taliban is it trying to gain more international legitimacy? What does it want to do with it? I'm sure there must be a much more deeper reason between Russia and Taliban coming closer, and Wagner returns to action in Africa. But did it ever leave that place in the first place?
So let's start with the executive. So if it were an isolated incident, I would say, you know, this is a 55-year-old man. At that age, there are sometimes critical cardio issues. It's a well-known fact that there is a high rising risk factor. The Japanese known to have a very hard work ethic. The climate in Russia is not the best this time of the year. He may have been under a lot of stress. You know, it happens. The problem is, this is not an isolated incident. Within the span of just a few months, there's been a slew of assorted medical issues that took down many people, including people younger than him, including the son of a very senior Russian official who was 35 when he had this incident, a burst artery or whatever it is that they claimed it was. And so after a few of these incidents, you start to wonder, how is it that anyone of any importance in Russia is receiving such poor medical care that they just drop dead, you know, on practically a daily basis, you know? It's interesting enough. So the way Russia looks at business people is not necessarily the way Japan or the United States or any other country looks at business people. When the U.S. sends a business person, you know, when they go from somewhere, they're there to make money. They're there for their own benefit to build up their industry. Yes, they would love to, you know, they generally like, hope that their country will benefit from that. But ultimately, private industry people are there for themselves. But that's not how Russia views it. They view any major business as a representative of their country, regardless of their motive and their line of business. From the Japanese perspective, you know, Japan and Russia, let's just say it plainly, they've had long-standing disputes even preceding the war in Ukraine. And now that Russia has aligned with China, Japan has basically shifted its political position. But, you know, but its business executives are still private citizens. They still have private interests that are not always aligned with the country's official foreign policy. However, that is not how necessarily Russia sees it. And if it sees that there is a major political realignment taking place, and they have an executive who is right there, and that executive is seen as symbolizing the political interest of the country, and he is asked to carry a particular message or act as a political man, and he refuses because he's just a businessman who wants to make money and doesn't really care about politics, you know, the Russians may take it the wrong way. They may still continue to try to present this person's presence as a political message to the country, even if he has nothing to do with the government whatsoever, even if the government doesn't even necessarily approve of what he's doing there. So, obviously we will not necessarily know the full truth of these circumstances in the near future, but it does look very much like, even though this person had close ties to the Kremlin, even though he was not necessarily anti-Russia, the Russians didn't care about his personal individual views and commitments. They were looking at sending a message to the government by presenting the fact that anybody from that country who is doing business in Russia is at high risk so long as Japan continues the taking the positions that it does.
Right, right. So how will Japan look at it? How is it looking at it? How will Japanese look at, businessmen look at dealing with Russia? And so I don't know much about the relations between Japan and Russia. So how do you see that panning out?
Well, Japan and Russia have had a dispute for nearly a century at this point over islands that Russia has occupied and never returned. And at various points in time, they have tried to negotiate the future of those territories, but it has never come to anything. So, as you recall, early in the 20th century, the Russia and Japan fought a war. And there's been, some bad, some really bad aftertaste in their relations since that time and throughout the Second World War and then afterwards. I mean, in recent decades, Japan was doing business with Russia just like everybody else. But as soon as things started really going sour, they started seeing that Russia is turning not into an enemy of China, as many have tried to make it happen, but rather as a very close ally. And simultaneously, it was also causing independent problem for Japan with its own position. Strategically, by occupying those islands, Russia essentially made itself into a threat. When you occupy another country's territory, you can use it against that country. You can use it, in theory, for everything ranging from espionage to potential attacks. So this is the background. So even though there was a lot of business going on, politically, there was never, the relationship was never very good, and it has gone from bad to worse. And I don't think this incident helped at all. First of all, there's absolutely no way to establish that this person died of natural causes. It may certainly appear that way. Who knows? I don't think we will hear about it. I do think that, it looks suspicious. It doesn't look particularly good in light of the other previous incidents. Yes, it could happen to anybody, but for whatever reason, we never hear about other Japanese executives of the same age, just dying very quickly anywhere else in the world. So I think that while there's no cause for public scandal, I think this will be... this message will be interpreted on the background, and I think there may be an increased tension on the intelligence front between the two countries. I wouldn't be surprised at some point we will see some Russian diplomats getting expelled, or at the very least face greater scrutiny in Japan.
Right, right, Irina. That's an important point you made there. Now, Russia and Taliban holding talks. What does Taliban want from Russia, and what can Russia get from the Taliban?
So actually, the relationship between the Taliban and Russia has been growing for some time, specifically against the West. The Taliban and Moscow were never friends, to put it mildly. In fact, they were exactly on the opposite sides during the Cold War. The Taliban came out of, it was part of, or a result of the Western effort to use Islamic movements to counter communist threats. Not all of these Islamic movements were Islamist in nature, but the Taliban certainly is and was. However, pragmatic considerations forced them to reconsider their agenda after becoming isolated. They were looking for assistance to get back to power by any means. Russia at this point was far more concerned about the United States obtaining influence and giving the U.S. a black eye than about any sort of religious considerations. And so they were essentially supporting the Taliban with weapons, with political backing, and provided assistance in getting back to power. And once there, the Taliban is looking for any way to make money just to keep things going and to retain power. And Russia was one of the first countries willing to do business with them and then to grant them political recognition. And now Russia is looking to get them off the sanctions, international sanctions list. First of all, to make business easier for themselves. Second, to expand their circle of allies and get Taliban's help in getting themselves off sanctions list and getting support at the UN and in various international institutions. And also, again, to strengthen their foothold against the United States, because with the growth of terrorism in Afghanistan, there's also a greater chance that the US, NATO will eventually come back. And for Russia, Russia wants a foothold in that area. It's strategically important. It has lots of natural resources. Russia has an interest in building pipelines through Pakistan to Central Asia. So it's got a lot of things cooking, and Taliban is strategically important for that reason. And Russia doesn't care that they're Islamist, that they support various other terrorist organizations. Russia just wants what it wants.
Right. Right, Irina. Now let's move on to another big story that's making a lot of news. Israel in Gaza, seven aid workers, they get killed. Israel bombs, diplomatic center in Damascus. Iran says it will, it will take revenge. And so a lot of, Israel is coming out to be a big, first it was the attack on some journalists were killed. Earlier, it was the attack on hospital. Israel again came into that picture, though there were different views on that. But this particular attack on the aid workers, this looks like to be, giving an impression as if Israel is a bit more and not so much on control about these things. This has not happened much before. Help us understand what should we understand, especially of the death of the aid workers, and then also about how do you see Iran looking at its diplomatic center in Damascus.
So with respect to the hospitals, there's no question that the hospitals had terrorist presence and that Israel acted in such a way that it did not harm the patients and other civilian personnel, only the terrorists themselves, many of whom, by the way, were arrested rather than killed. So there's plenty of witnesses who can testify to that. The journalists were also turned out to be Hamas operatives, so they had a journalistic cover that doesn't make them journalists. With respect to this incident, this was an error. There was an incident with identification because they believed that a Hamas operative who was armed and dangerous may have infiltrated that particular convoy, which was operating, strangely enough, in the middle of the night in a conflict zone. Very dangerous endeavor under the best of circumstances during the night, very difficult. For whatever reason, such incidents don't occur in, for instance, Ukraine, where humanitarian aid convoys avoid areas during, late at night when it's easy to get shot. So that was the reason that there was a rash decision made to attack the convoy. And to give Israel credit, unlike Hamas, which never takes any responsibility for civilians killed as a result of its actions, Israel immediately took responsibility. It acted very swiftly and transparently in investigating the matter and providing the international community with answers, and it fired the people responsible. Now, the United States, by comparison, has had similar incidents in Iraq and other places where families were killed by mistake. I don't know, maybe they will pay compensation later or whatever the case may be, but certainly there was no international outrage about U.S. allegedly intentional trying to murder civilians. There was no, nobody broke trade relations or defense treaties with the United States over that incident, and certainly no one claimed that U.S. is an irresponsible actor just because of one erroneous decision in the heat of the moment in a conflict zone. So I think much of the international outrage is manufactured. Many of the people are already looking for pretext for other reasons, not because of this particular incident. And this incident served as a convenient cover. I do not believe that anyone actually thinks that Israel was trying to ruin relations with the United States, with the UK, with Poland, and so forth, by deliberately trying to kill their aid workers. It's not in Israel's interest to do so, clearly. It wasn't trying to antagonize anybody. It wasn't trying to murder civilians on purpose. In fact, Israel frequently puts its own personnel at risk, trying to minimize civilian harm. Unfortunately, you know, errors happen. It's a war. It's just going to happen. The best you can do is take responsibility and try to avoid it as best as you can from happening again, which is what Israel is trying to do. Turning it into a huge scandal benefits Hamas. It does not benefit these aid workers. It does not. It's not going to bring them back, and it's certainly not going to help put, you know, finish the war at all. As far as the other incident goes, interestingly enough, this was not the first time Israel killed RGC commanders, even senior ones. But it was the first time when they were inside a diplomatic corpus, when they were targeted, and it was the most, the highest number of these officials of that rank in one place, in one incident. It probably was the most serious liquidation of that sort since the killing of Qasem Soleimani. However, I think everyone who was counting on Iran's immediate retaliation was coming to rush decisions. I do not believe Iran. There was a story put out by US and by various other parties that allegedly Iran was planning to attack Israel's territory directly with a swarm of drones. Now, I think it's wise to be prepared for any eventuality. If I were Israel, I would not take anything for granted, and I would certainly try to deter Iran as much as possible, including by sending out potential warnings over the public nature, just in case Iran is planning something. But from Iran's previous modus operandi, they are never inclined to put themselves directly in danger. There's absolutely no reason for them to go do foolhardy things that will likely get their senior officials killed when they can cause a lot of damage later when everyone's guard is down, and by engaging in tried and true tactics which have worked elsewhere quite well. So don't expect them to be direct. I don't expect it to be immediate. I certainly don't expect it to target things that are very hard to reach. I expect them to try to do things that, through third parties, which may, by the way, be still Iranian citizens, but they'll be Iranian second-class citizens, like Azerbaijanis or, you know, other ethnic minorities. Or they could be mercenaries, or they could be, you know, various ethnic groups that Iran hires to do dirty work for them. Second, I expect it to be somewhere outside of Israel, where it will be harder for Israel to justify going after their targets directly. So they will try to, maybe they could attack embassies. They could try again to assassinate senior officials or private citizens or military traveling abroad. It will not be easy. As we have seen in the past, Iran has tried abducting and killing civilians around the world, and Israel's cooperation with security agencies in those countries has every time prevented those operations from being successful. The worst thing Iran could do, and they've also tried it in this past, is to target civilian Jewish or Israeli targets in countries where the security is not all that tight. We've already seen that happening in Europe. There's been arrests and reports of Hezbollah operatives, Hamas operatives. They've been arrested at various points in time, but there's always more where that came from. So I wouldn't be surprised if they tried something like that. They could also try, you know, essentially taking out some Israeli military targets, but again, nowhere near Israel. It could be some joint operation with some other country somewhere else. And again, it would be done through Hezbollah or some terrorist organization, not directly through Iran, just like what they've done in Argentina with the Israeli embassy and Amir Center bombings in the 1990s. So something like that is certainly plausible. It's going to take planning. It's going to take time. And they're going to look for the optimal time when Israel is at its weakest politically, when it's distracted, and when other countries are distracted by other events as well. Not when everybody's closely watching and fully armed and ready. There's no reason for Iran to rush. And we've seen Iran take its time. They've tried to assassinate U.S. officials involved in the decision to liquidate Qasem Soleimani, and they've taken years to do that. And they're still trying to do that years after it happened. So I think that timeline is very different from ours. And I think it's a mistake to right now to wait for an immediate strike and then to relax. I think we should be doing exactly the opposite, to expect Iran not to do anything drastic right now, but to actually start watching closer the more time passes.
Right, right. So about this aid workers' death, do you think, you know, more and more countries are now speaking against Israel? What do they want? Does Israel need to hire some great PR agency so that its image, you know, gets bolstered on the international stage? Some of people seem to be getting a different view of Israel than the Israel that they knew.
I do think that there is a diplomatic failure on Israel's part, quite frankly. Yes, a lot of this is just pure anti-Semitism or domestic political considerations or some other geopolitical interests that have nothing to do with anything Israel could or would do. Qatar has a lot of influence on the international stage thanks to generous donations. Iran, Russia, China are all acting against Israel through directly and indirectly, and the United States is struggling to deal with the fact that its foreign policy in the Middle East is failing, and the only country it can pressure and yell at is Israel. It's a typical move of somebody who is cornered, who doesn't know what to do, to go after the easy target rather than try to fix their policy and go after the targets. Iran doesn't listen to the U.S. Hamas doesn't listen to the U.S. So the only way to make themselves look stronger in an election year is to go after Israel, because they're an ally, they're a democracy, they're dependent on U.S. political and military support. So, of course, it's easier. And UK just follows what U.S. is doing politically because of the closer relationship with them. But they also have elections coming up. And in UK, unlike the U.S., the pro-Hamas voices have a much stronger hold. They're a much greater percentage of the population. They're much more politically influential. And so that's actually a much bigger real problem for the UK elections than for the U.S. Now, when it comes to Israel itself, what should it be doing? What should it have done from the very beginning of the war? It should not have made itself look like one country going after its own personal problem. This should have been presented as an international problem, and Israel should have built a coalition based on recognition of common regional threats. The Iran threat, the Muslim Brotherhood threat, the fact that Hamas is a, you know, that Hamas has been, you know, concerned as a terrorist organization by Arab countries as well as various other countries. This is the platform it should have pushed for a unified solution. Then it would have made it much more difficult for these governments to criticize Israel later, because they would have been part of the operations.
Right, right. And as you said, U.S. policy on the Middle East seemed to be failing. So now they are thinking of, you know, because thinking of removing the terrorist designations from Houthis again. What does it mean? Just because there are reports that the Houthis are running out of weapons, so they might what, become some peacekeepers or something? Help us understand this new outlook from Washington DC, if at all these reports are correct.
So I think the reports of Houthis running out of weapons are premature, because just the other day after this announcement, they attacked another ship. So I think they've still got a little fire in them. But I think U.S. is also desperate. It refuses to listen to the advice of strategists who who advised that US should be going after more serious targets, not some radar systems or missiles that are replaceable and could be built internally without even having to export it from Iran at this point. But they should be going after Houthi leadership and after Iranian leadership and essentially taking them out and taking out very serious objects in Iran, serious military targets that are of value, that are hard to replace, not just things that are, you know, can be knocked down and built up in 2 days or so. US does not wish to do that. Part of the reason is that it's militarily less prepared than ever. Than everyone expected it to be. Another part is still just political ideology of the current White House and the administration, which is very, you know, basically similar to Obama in that regard. And a part of it is that they are overwhelmed. They're in an election year and they don't know what to do. So now they are trying to they think that Houthis can be induced with political incentives like normal players, so that if you give them a, you know, first a stick and then a carrot, they'll change their minds. But there's no way to enforce Houthi commitments to do that. All they're doing is making themselves look weak and desperate. No, you should not be offering terrorists incentives to, you know, remove designation, you know, 5 minutes after you put it on, when they have not changed in years, you hatred and they hated to your destruction, because part of Houthi's slogan is death to America, and this preceded this current attack, and I think they mean business, and they would do much more damage if they could, or if Iran let them. But the situation is very clearly being controlled very well, and you know, for all the, you know, attacks, Houthis lost very few people as a result of US missile attacks. There was maybe a couple of dozen at most that were killed as a result of this. This is not a lot. The damage has been very limited to their military installations, and so there's no particular fear of repercussions here. So they still feel very much in control, and this is not how you get someone to the table, by making them feel like they're an equal partner. You get them to the table by making them feel like they've lost everything and they'll lose even more if they don't go to the table now. And this is what that US is failing to understand here.
Absolutely. And amidst all these conflicts, ISIS seems to be making a comeback. So how is it doing so? And you know, building forces in Afghanistan. So this time, who will it be a bigger threat to? Again, the US or other part of the world? Help us understand about this ISIS comeback reports.
So interestingly enough, because of the Moscow attack, everybody's been looking at this ISIS Khorasan, which is Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asia, Iran. But actually, Iran has been making a comeback everywhere. It has been rapidly growing in Africa. It has been returning in the Middle East, in both Iraq and Syria, especially in light of Iraq U.S. withdrawal talks. And you see measurable spike in sympathy even in Europe and elsewhere. So it's not true that it's just ISIS-K that's been growing. But what has changed about ISIS-K is that from being a local organization focused on toppling Taliban and going after Shia groups and Sufis and whoever else in Afghanistan, they are now globalizing their presence, just like the original ISIL in Levant has done in the past. They are now going attacking other countries, and they are looking to recruit more so in Central Asia than previously, but also in the West. They're also targeting the West. There is a good likelihood that they may try to do something during the Olympic Games in Paris. They're certainly looking to target Europe at some point in the future, even if it's not now. And they've been much more successful at recruitment, and they've also been adapting English language propaganda for the Western audiences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now let's look at the economic side of things. And Egypt has done a big deal with UAE and also gone for IMF bailout. What is happening to the Egyptian economy? What do you see their economy's future in the coming days?
So Egypt has agreed to devalue its currency. It has also created major, basically, investment in real estate adjacent deals with UAE, and IMF saw that these measures are significant enough that it can safely give large loans to it without, you know, fearing a default or irresponsible spending. So I think this is a major breakthrough from Egypt, but it's certainly not totally out of the waters, because this is going to be a very long and difficult road ahead. Regardless, it spent a lot on things that people argued were not necessarily a top priority. At the same time, however, it was also dealing with legitimate crisis from the grain shortage resulting in spiked prices, inflation as a result of the war in Ukraine. There's been pressure from Ethiopia and the water disputes there. There has been other, you know, US has committed 500 million dollars in climate change money, and that actually never came through. So so there's been a conflagration of different factors and long-standing internal issues that have been dating back to Nasser's days that have never been fully resolved. You know, so all these factors came together, and it's been very difficult. You know, of course, also that made it difficult. And you know, this was also the issue with the Mediterranean gas forum. Israel's gas exports to Egypt have been on the rise previously. Now there's a war, there's a lot of uncertainty over the future of this gas, but actually, surprisingly, it has not been as bad in that particular regard as one could expect. On the contrary, so it looks like Egypt could make some progress in the near future. What that would look like remains to be seen. There's been a lot of criticism over the internal decision making and priorities by various officials over managing the economy. The one thing everybody agrees on is there needs to be a lot more economic liberalization and removal of the military from the economy, and it looks like there are some laws and reforms in the pipeline and on their way. However soon they come, that can't be soon enough, because it's a large population, there's a lot of opportunities. It can be hampered down by political corruption and control of sectors by, you know, various political factions. There needs to be an opportunity for regular people to enter business and to be able to move quickly to make money.
Right. And the last topic for the day is about Facebook stealing data from Snapchat. That's the report are saying. They say that it used illegal spying. So tell us about this, what this is all about. Here Pegasus also comes in. I wonder why Israel did not use more of Pegasus for their own thing. It's their company.
So here's the ridiculous part, and this is what I've been saying for some time now, and it's now starting to unravel. I always suspected that, you know, that Facebook's opposition to Pegasus was more about some business interest than about its concern for data privacy. After all, why would a private social media company care about a political tool that's used by governments? And to the extent it was concerned, its problem should have been with the US government or other governments that are using the tool and not with the tool itself. So what turns out that Facebook has been engaged in antitrust violations for several years now. They've been trying to control the market and get rid of its competitors like Snapchat. And to employ that, they hired another Israeli company, which consisted of very young kids who were basically manipulated into snooping and gathering data from Snapchat that allowed Facebook to make decisions and on the basis of illegal obtained information. So what did they do? They did exactly what they accused of governments that use Pegasus of doing. They illegally spied, not out of any major security threat, not because there was a good reason, just basically industrial espionage to put themselves in a better position. What happened to the data afterwards, nobody knows, but I suspect it could get a lot of worse. So ironically, Facebook joined a major lawsuit against NSO Group, the producer of Pegasus, over alleged violations, but now it turns out that its only concern was to ensure that only Facebook and its third-party partners can engage in any sort of snooping on social media companies so that they could control all of it. They don't care about national security, that the governments need those tools to prevent terrorism. Heck, Twitter even sold blue check accounts to various terrorist organizations. So, you know, behind all of these, you know, campaigns to ban commercial spyware lies entirely a self-interest in control, in being the only source of commercial spyware for the benefit of its own monopolistic practices. It's really as banal as that.
Absolutely. There is a lot going on in the world. And a lot needs to be made sense of. Every second, every 2 weeks, we'll continue to come to you, Irina Shukerman, to make sense of it all for all of us. With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of The World According to Irina Shukerman on the KJ Masterclass Live. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much.